Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, coffee party listeners out there. This is Debbie Lynn Molyneux calling in from Portland, Oregon today. Looking forward to a lively show today as we talk about austerity, sequestration, the economy, all those things that kind of make our eyes glaze over sometimes. But it's really important to how we live together in our country here and actually in the world as a whole. And I want to give a shout out today to my co-host today, Michael Charney, and say thanks, Michael, for sitting in as co-host today while Janine takes a week off.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
Yep, glad to have you with me. So we're talking coast to coast today. How are things in Massachusetts?
New Hampshire, actually, but that's okay. Ooh. People sort of conflate New England into one sort of entity, then they refer to it as Massachusetts. We're used to it.
And our guest is from Massachusetts today, so I'm getting myself all mixed up.
It is cold, and we're awaiting the arrival of Q, which is not an old Star Trek character in this case, but a rather heavy-looking storm headed our way. It's been wreaking havoc on the Midwest for the last couple of days.
And here we go again. But climate change isn't real. So, you know, I keep making fun of that, but I can't wait till we actually deal with this. So welcome, everyone, today. And again, thanks, Michael, for sitting in with us today. I'm excited to have our guest join us here in a few minutes and get really talking about, like, what are some of the things that we really make assumptions about as we make economics forecasts. And I've been boning up today on all of the economic news and modeling that's out there in the world. And boy, there's a lot to learn, and my eyes were glazing over. I ran across this graphic of Jackie Chan with his hands over his ears going, "You make no sense." And I just thought that was kind of key. I almost put that in for our graphic on the email blast today instead of the $100 bill with the belt tightening, because it just seemed more appropriate. And I thought, I should be serious about it. It's a serious topic.
It is, but the eyes glazing over thing is absolutely true. On the other hand, you know, one of them has to be right. And you can't have that many different ways of thinking about the world and not accidentally have one of them right. We just need to figure out which one it is.
Yeah. Well, and I don't even know that one of them has to be right, but probably parts of all of them have something right in them. And which model is it that's going to work? And that's, I think, part of what we put out in the email blast is, you know, could we all at least agree on, let's try this one and make it so? Because this is the one that we want to create for the future. And what is that future that we want to live in?
Well, I think it also has something to do with determining what it means to have an economic model succeed. And when do you stop pretending that one that has failed continues to succeed? I think that I think that's part of America's history, is that inability to either adhere to a model long enough to find out if it works or to admit when it doesn't. Models become ideological instead of tools, which is what they should be.
Right, yeah. I mean, because when we're running a business, and I understand government's not a business, but when we're running a business and we run a, you know, a forecasting model that's obviously not working, we don't wait for, you know, it does have a limited life plan, and if we wait for so long, we do change it fairly quickly. So how long do we give government for a model, you know, an economic model to work before we change it?
I think even asking the question would be a step in the right direction.
And not holding on to that ideology as you've talked about.
Yeah.
So, hey, Jack, I just want to give you a shout out. I see your hand up there, and we're waiting for our guest to join us, and we're going to talk to our guest first before we take callers today. So I just want to give you that shout out, Jack, that it'll be about probably 25 minutes before we take callers today. How, you know, Michael, you own a small business and I own a small business, and when how is it that, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of people talk about comparing a family budget or a business budget to the government. How are some of the ways that you think that those are all different?
Oh, in every way, in absolutely every way. I mean, I think the continued use of the homeowner analogy or the family analogy is just wrong. I mean, it is multidimensionally more complicated, and a government has a different purpose, right? A government doesn't necessarily have to invest for its own retirement, for example. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have the same responsibilities to individual. It doesn't have families to lean on. I mean, you know, in rough times, it's not like you go, hey, Canada, can you loan me a few trillion? It doesn't. The analogies just fall apart so quickly. And the assumption that government's role even is, you know, caretaker, breadwinner, the way parents are in a family, caretakers and breadwinners. Mm-hmm. I don't think that analogy holds up either. I think there are very few ways in which they are logically similar.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things that, as I was reading this morning too, that they are different, that was pointed out, is that most, when we're thinking about debt and retirement of debt and paying things off, that we think about in terms of family or business debt as well, especially small business debt, is that we're looking at the lifespan of a person or the lifespan of the business versus the lifespan of a government and a country. And so there's not the same type of limitation, if you will, for having debt. So the article that I was reading was pointing out that, you know, government doesn't need to have like an end date, like all the debt needs to pay off before you die, because we hope our government isn't going to die, our country isn't going to die, then we have to have all the debt paid off by then.
Right, and we're not going to go homeless necessarily either.
Yeah, collectively, we hope not.
Yeah.
There certainly are people within our country who are going
to... No, certainly there are people, but I mean, the government is not going to suddenly not have a country to be in.
Right.
It tends to be ludicrous. I agree with you on debt to some degree. But I think I have a little bit more conservative/aggressive point of view on aiming to retire debt than many others.
Well, how much debt is too much, you know, for our country?
Well, it's generally phrased in as a percentage of GDP. And right now it's, I'm not sure what the number is. It's large. I mean, obviously, we're at 16 trillion. I'm sure our guests would have these. I'm loath to say incredibly stupid things
right
before we have somebody who knows what they're talking about on the show. There's also the question of when the recovery of the debt or when the paying of the interest on the debt becomes a burden on the government's ability to do other things, that this is my personal opinion, then I think it's worth looking at. And I want to be very clear to those people listening. I'm not talking about deficit. I'm talking about the debt, like two different things.
Right.
So the annual
right
deficit goes up and it comes down. And, you know, there are economic times, as we've been in the last few years, where it makes sense to run deficits. But the idea of continually building up debt with no end in sight, just seems to me fundamentally unsustainable.
Yeah. So yes,
I don't know if
it's economically the percentage of GDP.
Yeah.
Well, there's one of the other articles I was reading that talked about, well, you know, most of the world's currency at this point anyway is still U.S. dollars, and as long as the debt has to be paid in our own currency, what's wrong with just printing more? You know, and I kind of squirmed at that ethically because it's like, well, that devalues our currency, but. You know, as soon as our guest comes on, we'll talk about that a little bit too, because that's, you know, that was like an interesting little perspective. It's like, well, I don't personally have a printing press where I can do that, but our government does, or the Fed. It may not be the government, maybe the Federal Reserve, but, you know, and then we've got that whole relationship that's kind of murky.
Hey, Darlene, you're starting to sound a little wah-wah on your phone.
Okay.
Oh, that's better now. That's better now.
All right.
Yeah. The whole printing money thing got very interesting when they talked about printing the trillion-dollar coin, right? So, it sort of makes me wonder if the whole thing isn't somehow gamed, and I'm very curious to hear our guest's take on this, because in theory, if you don't put the money in circulation, then it shouldn't have any effect on inflation, I wouldn't think. And I don't know. It's sort of, even the idea of money has gotten fuzzier and fuzzier in recent times. I'm very insecure with the concept. I'm insecure with my understanding of the concept. I used to feel much more confident in my stupidity. Now I'm really, really aware of my own ignorance.
Well, and I think the bankers like it that way, quite frankly. But I do want to say
that's probably true. And I worked in the financial services community for a number of years as well, which is even scarier.
Yeah, that is. Well, our guest has joined us here. I'm going to introduce here Mattia Kramer with the National Priorities Project. She's the director of research, and she leads the National Priorities Project research program covering such topics as the federal budget process, the federal spending and tax policy, federal health programs, Social Security, military and homeland security funding, and debt and deficit, what we were just talking about, Michael. Mattia is the lead author of NPP's book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and she serves as a regular commentator for media outlets across the country. She's been on many national shows, and we are just thrilled to have Mattia on Blog Talk Radio with us today with Coffee Party Radio and Lunch with Loudon. So, Mattia, welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Great. And you're just a little bit soft on your sound, and I can't turn you up. So if you can work your volume just a little bit, that'd be great.
Sure, I will. Speak up.
Thank you. So welcome to the show today. You've heard the last couple of minutes of Michael and I talking about, a little bit about the economy and the possibility of the U.S. printing their own money as a way to satisfy some of the national debt. But first of all, one of the questions that I wanted just to ask you was, how do you think the economy is doing today, and what are some of the things that you're hearing out in the think tank world?
Well, generally we hear that the economy is moving in the right direction, but painfully slowly. So that means that there's more to do in terms of getting our economy back on track. The policies that you're talking about, whether it's debt and deficit or printing money, those things have everything to do with whether or not we're moving forward in terms of improving our economy or moving backward and taking things back to, more difficult economic times.
Right. So what are some of, when we start talking about the economy, Michael and I were also talking about how confusing it is to understand a lot of this, of all the different moving parts, if you will, when you start looking at an economic forecast. Can you kind of give us a basics 101 on what are some of the things we should be looking at in the economic forecasting, and what are some of the underlying assumptions that people have about it?
That's a huge question. are there particular pieces that you're most interested in exploring?
Well, we're talking about the sequester and the austerity today. So I guess if we could focus in on areas that people are looking at specifically for when they start looking about sequester and cutting government spending across the board.
Sure. Well, one of the most important gauges of how the economy is doing is unemployment and how many jobs the economy is creating or how many jobs we're shedding. And, in recent months, for some time now, when we've looked at the jobs report that comes out, on a monthly basis, we've seen that the federal government is shedding jobs. So the private sector has been adding jobs slowly but positively, and the federal government has been shedding jobs. And so that creates a drag on the economy. And, I think most folks agree that getting people back to work is one of the most important priorities that we could focus on right now. So in terms of the sequester, now just a week away, estimates vary, but some estimates put the impact of the sequester in 2013 at a cost of 2 million jobs lost as a result.
Yeah, I've been hearing that number. In fact, my mom works for a defense contractor, so I know she's very concerned. And of that 2 million, you know, how do you have an estimate on, like, how many are in what different sectors?
Defense jobs make up less than half of the anticipated job losses, but, you know, less than half of 2 million, you know, is still substantial. So there will certainly be, you know, contractor jobs, absolutely. We've heard yesterday, actually, the Department of Defense announced that 800,000 civilian employees would be furloughed. And then the balance, so more than half of that estimated 2 million job losses would occur in other sectors, you know, from healthcare to education. And, you know, that also includes the effects of sequestration in the private sector. So because people would directly lose their jobs because of government spending cuts, there would be second and third tier effects, right? So people spend less money when they lose their jobs, or people spend less money when they're furloughed, and that sucks money out of the economy. And so we would ultimately see private sector job losses as a result, because businesses would see their business reduced.
Right. So we're talking here as far as one of the factors in economic modeling, which is employment. And the effects of a sequester would be a massive job loss. You know, so 2 million job loss. So some of the things I was reading this morning said that since the recession hit, we've actually gained like 4.3 million jobs, I think it was, is what we've recovered. So this would...
Yes, right. So we're moving slowly in a positive direction.
Right. So we lost, I forget how many jobs we lost, but we've recovered 4.3 million of them. And so this would be taking us back, like, by losing almost half of what we've recovered.
That's right, and it's important to keep in mind that what we've recovered is just a fraction, and I also can't remember, you know, what the total job losses were from calculated from the Great Recession, but we've recovered scarcely a fraction of them, and so this would be a setback in light of that very weak recovery.
Right, and I think, Michael, did you have something that you wanted to add in here? I saw your mic go live.
Yes, I first of all, thank you for joining the show, Mateo. Appreciate it. I wanted to ask a little bit about the way numbers are thrown around and the degree to which we can sort of trust what we hear. So for example, you mentioned the 2 million figure. I saw a report from MarketWatch that came out, I think, 2 days ago that had the number at 700,000. I've also heard the 800,000 furlough number, but then I heard that really was 800,000 people who would be furloughed one day a week, which has an effective rate of 160,000. So how are we supposed to interpret all of these different numbers? And related to that, how are we supposed to sort of see through the effort to make us afraid, which, of course, is how the media gets its ratings on these things?
Sure. Well, we hear lots of numbers, and they're not necessarily in conflict, but they're likely measuring different things. I mean, certainly we sometimes hear numbers that are wrong, too, but the fact that numbers are different doesn't mean that they're wrong. So the 700,000 figure in terms of job losses from sequestration, I believe that's direct job losses, so folks who would directly lose their jobs as a result of government spending cuts. But there's second and third tier effects, which have also been calculated. So what will the total impact on the economy be as a result of sequestration? And so that adds substantial additional job losses to the 700,000. I believe that's the difference between those two figures. But this is something that we see in federal budget numbers and, you know, numbers about the economy all the time. They're confusing. It's easy to spin numbers by measuring different things and sort of not talking about precisely what it is you're measuring.
So I'm sorry to belabor this one, but I'm feeling really stupid, and I don't generally think I'm a stupid guy. But how does a person like me with very little economics background, interpret that? When we talk about the 700 versus the 2 million, so when I hear things like second and third job losses, my business hat goes on and says, well, maybe those are job openings that will go away, but they're not actually people working, or they are
you know, monetary equivalent effects because people are spending less, so downstream 2, 3, 4 years less people are being hired. How's the average person supposed to interpret that in a meaningful way, acknowledging that there's, you know, lots of different numbers floating around?
Sure. I think in a practical way, you know, thinking about, you know, you just mentioned the civilian furloughs at the Department of Defense, and yes, those folks would be furloughed one day a week, and they would see their take-home pay decline by a not insignificant amount over the course of, you know, the month and the year. Those
right.
folks have less money in their pockets, and that means they have to figure out how to make ends meet now on those smaller paychecks, and that means they're going to spend less money in every way they can. And so that means all the businesses that they frequent will see, you know, so, you know, in particular in places where there's lots of defense employees, so, you know, in Virginia and Maryland, businesses in that area are likely to see their business go down. And that could result and certainly will result in some cases in job losses. And so
okay.
those aren't direct job losses as a result of sequestration, right, because those are private sector employees. But they would certainly, the effects are real, the job losses would be real. But I am certainly sympathetic to your point that this stuff is complicated, and it's difficult to make sense of these numbers getting thrown around.
Definitely true. Thank you.
Sure.
So, Natia, thanks for that, because I was with you on what that was about. And one of the things that I keep hearing about here is the difference. You know, I keep hearing like all the Keynesian economists are going, yay, yay, you know, Keynesian economy work, the economy model works. Can you talk a little bit about what that means compared to like the austerity model in Europe?
Sorry, they're cheering which model?
I want to say Keynesian. Keynes?
Keynesian.
Yes. Thank you for telling me how to say it.
No problem. Economists who espouse Keynesian principles, generally when folks say that means that government spending can give the economy a boost, and it could be spending or tax cuts, as both are part of what Keynesian economics encompasses. But the point is that the government can take certain actions in an economic downturn to essentially step in when the economy is flagging, when private demand has declined, and give the economy a boost that it needs to get going again. The upshot is some inflationary side effects. So you guys, I know we're talking about that before I came on the phone, but the benefits would be real. So you would have, down the road you would see inflation, which, you know, folks argue about whether or not some inflation is good or bad. And the upshot is that the government helped to boost the economy at a time when private demand couldn't make a recovery on its own.
Great. Anybody have, Michael, you have anything to add on that or questions about it?
Thank you for the explanation. I've looked, not that long ago, a book came out called Keynes Hayek, or Hayek, I guess it's Hayek, which was a very interesting sort of semi-biography economic discourse on the two viewpoints. And I came away, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, I came away thinking that we're all Keynesians, just some of us admit it and some of us don't, and that the Democrats use social programs fundamentally and infrastructure kinds of programs for their Keynesian pro formas, if you will, and the Republicans tend to use defense, right? But ultimately, lots of government deficit spending has been the rule in both cases, and that we've never really tried in any real way anything else. What would you say to that sort of an interpretation?
I absolutely agree that both parties espouse different elements of Keynesian economics, and that Democrats are likely to do it with social programs or infrastructure projects. Republicans use defense spending or tax cuts.
Right.
And they're all intended to have the same effect, which is to put more money in the pockets of the American people, and they will therefore spend more, and that will get the economy going. We have tried other things, though. Prior to the New Deal, there was no Keynesian economics because this was just this school of thought was just coming to the fore, and the Great Depression was that moment that required what was then a new idea, which was that government should step in and spend a lot more when times are bad, as opposed to the austerity model that government should spend less when times are bad because it doesn't have any money to spend, right? If it wants to run somewhat balanced finances, then when tax revenue goes down, it has to spend less. So that had been the dominant model prior to the New Deal. And the New Deal turned that on its head and said government's going to spend a lot more when the economy is down in the dumps, and that will put money directly in people's pockets, and eventually we will get out of it. Now, the New Deal didn't actually achieve that. It took the biggest government stimulus program ever, World War II, to actually get out of that slump.
Right. And then there's the dirty little Keynesian secret, which is that Keynes believed that once you got through it, you needed to pay it back. My understanding is he wasn't in favor of continually increasing debt.
Absolutely. So, right, so the time for austerity is when times are good. That's when the government ought to roll back spending, reduce deficits, pay down its debt, exactly as you're saying.
So how do we get out of this loop? Basically, everybody wants to spend more than we have. Nobody wants to pay it back when times are good because, hey, when times are good, our American psyche says, let's spend some more, right? At least until we create another interesting bubble that will blow it all up. So how do we... Is it fundamentally American to be stuck in this loop, or do you see, as an economist, a way out?
No, I do think that we won't be stuck in this forever. I am of the thinking that the government ought not to be cutting spending right now because of what we talked about before, that harms our economic recovery. But I do believe that deficit is the time for deficit reduction. And that time will be when the economy is on more solid footing. And I believe that there are great opportunities for deficit reduction, and you know, some of them are sunsetting, you know, wasteful military programs. You know, we can do better on healthcare cost containment. We can close tax loopholes. So there are ways of reducing deficits. I hear your point. You know, when times are good, Americans want to spend more then too. I'm not sure of the political feasibility of the policies I'm outlining, but I do think that there are very real and smart opportunities for deficit reduction when the time is right.
Well said. I agree with you. I think if there's a bit of a cynic in me, and those who listen to me on my own show know that there is, that I think what worries me the most is that we built a consumer society, and we want to consume cheaply when we can't, and we want to consume squared when we can. And that I think that, for me, is the big question, the cultural question that's underlying a lot of this. Debbie Lynn, I don't know how much time our guest has. Do we want to see if we can take a couple of callers? And
well, yeah, we just have a couple more minutes here, and I actually just have kind of one last question for you, and that is, like, can you kind of give us like a brief overview, Mattia, about like, everybody's afraid we're going to go the way of Greece or Europe with the austerity programs. Can you explain to us, like, why that is or is not possible here?
Well, I don't think that is in the cards for us at all. A major difference between us and those countries, you know, Greece or these devastating examples, right now and for the foreseeable future, the U.S. Treasury bond is still one of the best investments out there. Now, our politics makes that less so, but not our ability to keep up with our debt service, that is, to pay the interest that we owe and continue to make good on our debts. So that puts us in a very different position, that we are and continue to be able to borrow money, and currently at an extremely inexpensive rates. So in that way, we are on very solid footing, and I know, I know folks don't necessarily see how that could be the case, given the size of our debt. But there aren't so many safe places to go in the world with your money, and the U.S. Treasury continues to be one. And so, we can use that to our advantage. And as part of our recovery, we need not undertake a devastating austerity package unless, you know, our politics makes it the only option. But we need not go that way unless we choose it.
Right. So this is a matter of so what we can do as citizens is just keep up the pressure on our politicians saying, no, we do not want that.
You betcha.
Okay. So that's I guess the big message I wanted to get out to everybody here today, because this is an advocacy organization. And Mattia, I'm trying to get you out of here right on time because you said you had somewhere else to be. And I just want to thank you so much for being our guest today here on Lunch with Loudon.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you. What a great conversation. We have federal budget resources at our website. I just want to throw that out there for folks. It's nationalpriorities.org. If folks want information about what's going on and all of this federal budget nonsense, we'll try to help you. So I hope folks will visit the site.
I'd like to add in a good word to visit that site. Mateo, the federal income tax receipt where you can see how your money is being spent, actually your own money is being spent, and is great. And the metaphor of being able to actually print out a receipt is just wonderful. I'm looking at it and going, oh my God, it's so easy to understand it now.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and as tax season comes into full swing here, we will be getting that out to everyone we possibly can, so that as you pay your taxes, you can see exactly how that money was spent.
I'm going to put the link up to that on our chat room so that people can go play with it and determine whether or not they personally want to be frightened by what they see. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
So thanks again to everybody. Sorry for the double speak there. I'm having just a couple of technology issues today. So thanks again to Mattia. And, yeah, do go to nationalpriorities.org, and you can see the interactive program that they have there that shows you exactly how much of your tax dollars are going to which programs. It's an awesome way to look at that. So we're going to take callers now, and let's continue this conversation. We are going to continue this conversation again next week as well. And so let's get your thoughts on the austerity, the sequester, economics in general. And Michael's going to help me out in the chat room and add some nice conversation to it as well. So first up, we've got Jack. You've been holding a long time. And so welcome to Lunch with Loudon. Jack, I'm opening your mic now.
Okay, this is Jack Golding. You hear me?
I can hear you fine, Jack. How are you today?
I'm fine. Now, okay, the thing I wanted to say that I didn't say on Saturday is that I belong to Citizens Against Government Waste. And I think we can cut a lot of waste out of the military and defense contractors. They insist, people insist upon going upon programs of aircraft or whatever the heck it is, and the Defense Department don't want it.
So this is related.
It creates jobs or something like that.
So this is connected to, you know, so continuing on the conversation we've just been having with talking about the budget and the debt and everything. So you think that one of the places that we could help cut in debt is through defense cuts?
Yeah, well, certain contractors like they've hurt Iraqis. I mean, they were harmful in a lot of respects.
So I'm not familiar with that company at all. So do you have a little more information?
I can't think of names very well. But they're very big in Kansas and all that.
Okay.
Harrison or something like that. I'm the ones that I'm also thinking of the I'm more sympathetic to Obama. They're talking about who's to blame for the sequester we're in.
Okay, yeah.
And
so, Jack, are you talking about? You're talking about the company that used to be Blackwater that's named renamed
Exxon. Blackwater used to be Blackwater.
Yeah. Yep, they did do a lot of harm.
Yeah.
Hey, also, thanks for that, Michael.
Also, I can't think of the name in the right off the bat, but there are other things we can do, such as reforming 7,000 pages of the income tax, or 30,000 pages of the income tax code.
I know.
Get down to 100.
It used to be 100.
When it first began, it was 15 pages.
That would be Michael. You got something to say on that one?
Well, I want to go back, Jack. I think you bring up a really interesting and very complex point around the defense issue. And you started by saying, and you're 100% right, that we're actually building things the military itself has said they do not want.
Mm-hmm. But they're under contract to complete.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the contracts, I'm not an expert in this process at all, but the contracts have a variety of ways in and out of them. And even if we said we weren't going to do something in 2015 or 2016 or 2017, that would affect, you know, this 10-year budget cycle we're playing with in terms of getting to the $4 trillion that Obama wants. But it's a very, very tricky place we've put ourselves into in terms of how we make the cuts, or if we make the cuts. And when it comes to defense, Jack, the issue, of course, is that the vast majority of those people involved in those projects are civilians, right? They're
mm-hmm.
private. They work for Lockheed. They work for Martin Marietta. They work for BAE. They work for the
right. –
and I know this, you know, here in New Hampshire – and I think we have somebody in the chat room who's in Hawaii, which also has a very large defense industry. Here in New Hampshire, our second largest employer in the state is BAE Systems, and people around here are scared. So the question becomes, you know, how do you cut where you can, but not the kind of cuts that immediately mean civilian layoffs. You know,
right.
Or private sector layout, not just civilian, but private sector layout. It's a very tricky question. You can't just make those programs go away and not think that there's going to be a tremendous impact.
Well, and I just want to point out that, too, that I forget which senator or congressman it was that first suggested defense cuts back in, I want to say, in the 80s. It may have been in the early 90s. But they were from California District. Or from California, and I think it was in the Congress, because their district then saw closure of like 5 military bases that were all in their area, and it just skyrocketed their unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like through the budgeting process, they said, "Hey, we need to cut back here in the defense industry," and they said, "Okay, great, we're going to start at your home in your neighborhood." As this like so on the political level, there was like this punishment that they even dared to bring it up.
It's one of the largest industries in the country. And we've got lots and lots and lots of human beings, which translate into, you know, paychecks
mm-hmm.
that are tied up in these in many cases projects that aren't needed or 20th mm-hmm. century projects in a 21st century world. And I'm not so sure that big cuts in defense right now are the answer either. I think an audit of the Pentagon is in order, and I think that an analysis of, sort of a cost-benefit analysis of what we're working on.
I'd love to see an audit. Oh, my God, that would be so nice. Hey, we have 3 callers lined up. I just want to give you
Jack,
you both
thanks
a heads
for calling
up.
In and bringing that up. I think that's a really important point. It brings up the trickiness of some of these decisions that have to be made. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, Jack. I'm going to move on here. We've got a couple of known callers to me, and then I've got somebody that I don't know that hasn't called in for a while. So I'm going to go to Joe in Albany, and then Linda, you're up next. Joe, welcome to Lunch with Loudon. It's Debbie Lynn and Michael.
Hey, Michael. Good to be talking to you. Debbie Lynn, thanks for having me back. Good show so far. And you hit a topic I'm a little bit up on. I've been following it, pardon me, as well as a few others. Priority project that Ms. Kramer belongs to, I have on my website. So I am a little familiar with what's going on. To give a little perspective, the overall national debt, the long-term debt, we have been there before. We were there after World War II. I believe it was like 150% of GDP. With Ronald Reagan, we were at about 129%. Since President Obama took over, he's only added 48%. So if we didn't have the debt to begin with, or if it didn't increase as much, we wouldn't be in the kind of hole we're in. What Jack was referring to earlier basically is Halliburton, Blackburn contractors, which we use in place of our military. And there is tremendous waste there. I'll leave it at that. Now, the Keynesian theory or system, basically what a government tries to do is in times of hardship. This goes back to the Roman Empire, if not even the Egyptian Empire. You put people to work. When they work, they have money. That money, in turn, is spent. It's spent on products. Buying those products creates demand. That demand creates more work. Principally, that's how the system works. When it gets out of hand, you would then institute austerity. You would cut back. Now, in looking at our situation, some of the things that I'm seeing now, generally, I do have to go along with President Obama's plan. This has happened before. What they don't do is set limits. Now, an interesting thing was brought up with regard to the minimum wage to add a cost of living increase to it. If you were to apply taxes in a similar way, and I don't mean to increase them by cost of living, but if you could tie them to people's standard of living and our unemployment rate, reform the tax system so everybody's on an even playing field. Now, as unemployment would go up or down, you would then treat business the same way with their taxes. Their incentive would be, hopefully, to keep it low. In turn, taxes would go according to standard of living. As your standard of living improves, you get incremental increases in your taxes. As it goes down, you try to reduce that. Now, setting our goals and projects, if we, are going to do something. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Joe, so what you're talking about is still a progressive tax plan, which we've had in place, not as incrementally probably as you're proposing, which would be counterintuitive to the simplistic tax code that Jack was talking about. But you're talking about something that is, fairly progressive, which we've tried to do over coming years.
Well, true, but we've never put limits. We've never said, okay, your rate will be this much under these circumstances. We've never told corporations.
Oh, we just lost Joe. I don't know what happened to him. Joe, call back in. I hope you're listening online still. I'm going to go to Linda in the meantime, and then when you call back in, I'm going to let you jump the queue. So we can finish getting your point in. We've got two more callers on the line. Linda, you're live with Lunch with Loudon. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. You know who it is. It's Linda in Northern California. I used to live in Nashua, so I know Michael knows where that is. And my
I certainly do.
My ex, as far as I know, still works for Lockheed, Sanders, Martin, whatever they're called now.
It's BAE. It used to be Sanders. Now it's BAE.
Now, oh, that's what it's called? Oh, I didn't know who you were talking about. Okay. All right. They changed names again. So anyway, I assume he's still working there, and I remember how we would always get told, you know, to vote Republican at voting time because, you know, he wanted to keep his job, blah, blah. And so we kind of split on that one. But I spent a lot of my jobs, when I lived there, I did a lot of soldering on PC boards, you know, technical kind of things. So I was thinking along the lines of the kind of things my jobs, when I lived in an area that had a lot of military industrial complex type jobs. I agree with what you said the other day on your show. I believe it was you said something to the effect of gradually weaning down. You can't just make all these cuts to the military complex because there are a lot of people employed in those jobs.
Right. Yes, that was me. That was definitely me on the Tuesday night show.
Well, what I'm thinking of is as far as the gradual weaning us off of so much of a constant war economy would be like the kind of things I did. And when I worked in Amherst, we worked on things for the space system, you know, for the shuttle, gyroscopes and whatnot, you know. And so we would pull in contracts. I don't know if they're not really military. They're NASA. So, I mean, I'm a big one for Hubble, and, I mean, I love space and exploration, and I really would love to see us print more into knowledge versus war, but that's my liberal leanings. But I understand. I was also in the service for 4 years, and so was my ex, and he was also in the reserve, so I know about the bases being closed around there a lot because all of a sudden you had to travel for quite a ways to go to do your weekend duty. But I understand how it hurt the communities around those bases. So I think a gradual weaning away maybe towards the entrepreneurs out there, weaning us into green technologies, the kind of PC boards and people that are used to working on that kind of technology can easily, I would think, switch over to another technology that uses those same features or, you know, the same kind of system.
So, Linda, do you have like a – yeah, well, I mean, I guess we need to make sure that we have those kind of industries here in the States and not overseas. Do you have an idea as to what those might be?
As far as what kind of industries?
Yeah. And you know, Michael, pipe in here, too, if you might have an idea. Because, I mean, this has been the big question. The military has become such a big employer.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't mean to butt in.
Well, I don't know what else I was going to say there. It's just other than, you know, all those manufacturing jobs for those type of products, what do we produce besides war?
Well, the kind of things we worked on, we did things that we coated. We had it used to be Union Carbide, and then it was sold to another company, a British company. And then Union Carbide spun it off. But basically, we would take things like PC boards, which a lot of equipment uses nowadays, and we would coat with this kind of a state of the art thing called Perylene, which makes like a moisture barrier, so that corrosion and whatnot can't get to the components. So I was thinking that could be useful in any number of in applications. It wouldn't necessarily have to be space. I mean, some of the things we got, they were soldered in gold because gold doesn't corrode.
Right, exactly.
But you know what I'm saying, that anything where there's a lot of moisture I mean, we're talking, much as I hate oil drilling, but even oil rigs and things like that, there
but
must
for
be
energy.
A lot of salt. Yeah, any kind of thing where there's salt air, that you could use those kind of technologies. So that I could see where that could be.
Okay. Well, I can see, you know, anything along coastal areas then is, you know, where they need things like that.
Well, yeah, and where I live now, I'm in Northern California now, and we have what they're starting with the tidal generators to try to get power from the tide.
Yep, wave
and
energy.
We heard wind, and things like that. So I think if we really should get the maybe colleges, whatever, start training on the future entrepreneurs on how to think about ways to retool or repurpose these industries. That's all.
Right. Yeah. No. I like where you're going with that, Michael.
I think it's right on, Linda. There's so much technology that is generated through the defense industry there's got to be myriad ways to repurpose that into other industries. The trap, of course, is that while we've always been a nation of entrepreneurs and there are thousands of stories of self-made millionaires and technological innovations in the backs of garages, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that side by side with all those Horatio Alger stories is the federal government, and particularly the Department of Defense, which is arguably responsible for the greatest of all our technical innovations, which is the Internet, and certainly throughout the history of that complex. Most of what's in commercial airplanes began as defense projects. Most of our commercial satellites, it's all began as defense projects.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how can we make it interesting for the government to want to do research and innovate in areas other than defense, right? So defense has the advantage of it makes people afraid. And when you're afraid, you're willing to spend money to defend yourself.
To do anything, yeah.
There are no industries comparable to that. We're not sufficient. There should be energy, right? Energy and
actually,
environment should be there. But
There's one other one, and that's the healthcare industry. And I don't want to necessarily sidetrack conversation, but people are afraid of dying, and so the medical.
No, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. If the government were to spend the kind of innovation, money, and innovation, I agree with you. I don't think that that's a repurpose, though, right? That's a completely different kind.
It's a completely different industry.
Innovation.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you took and of course, you can't just take the same employees who are in defense and say, well, now you're going to be in this other industry. But if you could find a way to move the innovation incentive for government away from defense and into something like the healthcare industry,
mm-hmm.
I think you'd be on a track to brilliance.
Or even building low cost housing or something along those lines. That would be great. I just can't even begin to think of the things that we could do to actually improve our lives that are not fear-based. But
yeah,
fear
is
often the motivator. Hey, Linda, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to jump back to Joe here that we lost a few minutes ago and let him finish his piece. And then I've got two other people lined up. We have about 6 minutes left to the show unless we go over for a few minutes. So, Joe, you're back on Lunch with Loudon.
Yeah, sorry about that. I had an internet problem here. Linda's right. And an area we could look at in regard to trimming down the military, if you were going to do the military-industrial complex, areas they could go into are rail service, power transmission, and that could be done through the government to private industry with an infrastructure bank. Okay, and the Koreans, I read a piece online recently, have come up with electronic recharge pads, kind of like we recharge our electronic devices, but they're big enough to do buses. I think we could improve on that to where we could put these things on roads, on railroads, and the engines could then recharge themselves, saving our energy. Just one area. A lot of the technical things that we do in defense, right, can be transmitted, but it does involve government. You could bring private sector in through the use of an infrastructure bank, and it would look like a win-win. Business could make money, and people would have jobs. Training could be done through high schools in some cases, through community colleges, the more technical jobs. Of course, we could do degree people, but you could spread this out and hopefully promote a lot of prosperity. So Linda's on. She's right on with that.
Yeah, thanks for that contribution, Joe, and for calling back in. And really, I'm glad to have your thoughts on that today. And I like the idea of having some renewable energy there. I am going to be a little bit quicker here. We've got two more callers online. I'm going to 661. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon. Could you tell us who you are and where you're calling from? Oh, I got to open your mic. Hold on. There you go.
To me, this is like Berto. You guys have a great show going on here. That was a very interesting thing that I'm hearing with regards to government investment. I might understand that everybody on the call so far now is believing that government does have a role to play, and that government does in fact create jobs.
That's we know that they do. It doesn't mean that that should be government's only purpose, but we definitely government has a role to play. We've known that for some time.
Yep. Yeah, Egberto, this is Michael. I've written about this. There's no question in my mind that government creates jobs. There's no question in my mind that in some cases the government should create jobs. Whether we're creating the right ones at the right time is a whole different conversation. But there's no question about it. I mean, it's the fundamental basis of Keynesian economics.
Oh, wow, great. I mean, I was just happy to hear that, because I think when more people start to really see that, that's when we actually start to make progress. I was hearing a whole lot earlier in the discussion with respect to the military expenditures, and there's something that I don't think a lot of people realize, and that is a lot of the military expenditures are overseas. And when they're overseas, they generally spend money with third-party companies, let's say from India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all these places where the money doesn't flow back into resources of the country. But because those are rather cheap expenditures, the military folks become profiteers in that they take our tax dollars, they use it overseas for claiming military expenditures. And then a few, the owners of that, let's say Blackwater, as Joe was talking about before, and these other companies make the profit. So when I look at the sequester, I think what your topic was supposed to be, as far as I'm concerned, the sequester and the military should remain. On social programs, absolutely not. It is true that we could defer all monies away from foreign interests and bring it back home and not have San Antonio, which is a military base, not have San Diego, which is a military base, all the different ports in Virginia really suffer. I think the real problem is that we have all these corporations that conflate and don't actually present information for people to really understand. So they can come and say, oh, we stopped the carrier group from going into the Gulf when we could have moved money elsewhere.
Well, there's some of that. You know, some of that expenditures that goes overseas is with corporations that are still putting people to work here. And just so you know, my mom works for Lockheed, and she works on contracts with other countries. So the U.S. government isn't the only contractor that Lockheed works for. I guess that's what I'm saying. But
that's true of all of them.
So the sequester is going to impact Lockheed. And people she works with, maybe her, would get laid off. I don't think she will, but other people she works with. And there's a lot of fear in that. But they're not just solely U.S. contractors.
So, Egberto, I have a question for you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
Well, I just want to say, we're at time. I'm just going to give everybody a little heads up. We're going to go over probably about 15 minutes today. So just everybody hang on, and we'll get to you.
So, Egberto, if I heard you correctly, you're saying that the part of the sequester that affects the military is something that you would agree to allowing to go into effect in a couple of weeks. Is that correct?
I would allow that to go into effect, but not only that. I would then repurpose not to affect our American citizenry. In other words...
Okay, so there's the big question, right? Because the first half of your statement says, 2 weeks from now, you're willing to tell 800,000 people that 2 weeks from now, their pay is going to be cut by 20%. Which is effectively 160,000 people out of work.
No, I'm not willing to do that at all.
But that's what the sequester will do. That's why I think when we talk about the sequester and we talk about alternatives to it, it's important to realize that some things are very sudden if they happen and others aren't, right?
So the
defense furlough is an immediate effect.
You're correct. Right. I mean, I'm sorry. You're
we don't want that to happen.
No, you're correct. I misspoke. I meant... The dollar amount of the sequester for the military, I am for. For what has to be done that has been in the statute, I am not for. So you are correct that, no, I would not want – how many thousand people was it that you said?
Well, it's a 20% furlough for 800,000 people. So the net effect is 160,000 equivalent paychecks would be lost.
No, that's where I misspoke. I am absolutely not for any American citizen losing their jobs over what we know is a manufactured I think Obama called it recently, a manufactured something.
Meat cleaver. He called it a meat cleaver.
Right. So I mean, I am not for that. But what I am for is honesty in governing. And that's why I was so happy when I heard you make mention, and everybody else start to make mention about government investing in technology, because that is our problem right now. Our current institutions, those are the first places that they cut research and development, et cetera. And we don't have enough people that are stayed in those facts. I mean, here in Texas, it's draconian. Our next generation of kids are going to be dumb for what they've done to education and resources here in Texas to save money for not taxing appropriately. We are so rich in oil in Texas. We are in an energy boom. And you know what we're doing with the oil industry? We're giving them tax abatement.
Well, the minute that we started spending more money on prisons and safety and security instead of education, I just knew our priorities were all messed up.
Exactly. And that is what. When are we going to? And you know, that's what I love about a program like this. And then not only a program like this, but to hear somebody of Michael and Devlin's persuasion bring that particular thing up with regards to government investment in our people, because we don't have enough people that are out there. You know, I mean, you go to Joe Blow in West Virginia, and he's going to say, "Take the government out of the pocket. I'm tired of government. I'm tired of that." Not realizing that, and Michael, I don't want to sound too bad on this one, but the private enterprise has failed us in several areas. And wherever I'm not against private enterprise at all, but I'm saying wherever private enterprise fails, government should be right there to pick up.
Well, and not as a nanny state, but I think as a help for the community, Egberto. I want to just check you on that one a little bit.
I am with you there.
Yeah.
I don't want nanny state. But I want.
Yeah, no.
Can I make one important? Then I'll shut up. One
really, really quick, because we're going over. I got one more caller.
Yeah, we got one more caller.
Okay, this is gonna be a quick one. I believe that things like social safety nets is what liberates entrepreneurs to create. Because as a small business person, if health insurance and these other things weren't so difficult, there are a lot of people that I know in this business that would go ahead, quit their job, go on innovating, not being tethered to the job solely for health insurance. I think exchanges will make a big difference, and people are going to see that in the long run.
And apparently Rick Scott is beginning to agree with you.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Just one quick note on your way out of Gridon. This is something about me that both you and Debbie Lynn and the listeners don't know. My first job out of college was for the Department of Energy. I'm well aware that government can create jobs.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a classic, we're in a classic curve right now where, anytime there's a recession, the private industry loses jobs first, and then government cuts come later, and then coming out of it, it goes the other way around. So that's just the way it works. Hey, we've got one more caller here from area code 404. Thank you for holding on for so long. You're going to get the last caller word in on Lunch with Loud today. So can you give us your name and where you're calling from?
Robert Rodrigo. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello, Robert. Glad to hear you.
Thank you. I think there's a big hole missing in this discussion. I think that we've been backed into a corner about the job situation, and here's what I mean. I'll give you a specific instance. My niece is married to a gentleman who's in the banking community, and for the last 2.5 years, he has been flying overseas to train people to work under him in his section, where he used to have people who were making $100,000 or $80,000 or $70,000 a person, and now they can hire 25, 35, 45 people for the same salary combined of one person or two people in a section. So what's happening, and we all know that outsourcing is a big deal here, because
right.
in the private community, now we all like free markets, we all like profit. I have a corporation, all of that stuff being said. So what do you do about the companies who are sending jobs overseas, and then the people are working at such a low rate that there's no way that we'll ever get those jobs back into our economy unless we're going to punish the companies and make them go, lose their profit, or whatever the scenario could be, tax them, whatever it is. So where's the balance on that? We'll never get those jobs back. And you're talking about the banking industry, the auto industry, the technology industries, so many industries that are based in the United States that have done this. So you have that is creating such a large portion of unemployment. Then you tack on the discussion about the minimum wage. I personally think minimum wage should be at least 12, if not 15, up to $15, because at $9, if you just do $9 at 40 hours for 52 weeks, it's only $18,000 a year. No one in this country can survive on $18,000 a year without going to the government and getting some kind of assistance. So if mm-hmm. you make the minimum wage high enough, the balance is that you remove the burden of the safety net cost. You keep the safety nets, but you remove the burden of the safety net cost being used, because people can now at least get out of the level of poverty. I mean, $15 an hour, we're still only at $30,000 a year, for example. So you take those factors, and then I'll add another one. When you talk about the government, for example, and we're talking about the military, and you can even actually go on. If everybody goes on to the Google and just Googles Federal Prison Industries, Unicorn.
Oh, God. Don't get me started on that one.
Well, the federal prison industry, including the military, mm-hmm. and I've talked about this mm-hmm. before briefly on some of the shows, the military contracts with it, just the military by itself will take. We're only going to the other trades. The military alone, the Department of Defense, contracts through at least 10 different federal prison industry locations in this country to mm-hmm. do high-tech work. And the people who are doing it are not getting paid more, obviously, than $1.25 an hour.
Yeah, okay? Pitiful wages. Yeah.
Right, because they're prisoners. Okay, and I'm not necessarily saying the prisoners should be making more money. What I'm saying is that the government should not be doing that. They should not be giving contracts to Federal Prison Industries, a government-based corporation.
Taking all that work away
from the community.
Right, exactly, and that's the point. That's the point is
that's
they're
the,
not.
That's the point
they're,
I'm saying. Right, right. I'm not saying that congress can't work.
It's not an even right. playing field for the market, is what you're talking about. And
right.
then I have another
well,
thing
not,
on
it's
industrial.
It's not just that, because the Department of Defense, it's a laundromat is what it is. Because the Department of Defense is still charging us as the taxpayers the same
correct.
Amount of money as it would to somebody else who has the regular wages. So we're getting robbed.
So Robert, if you have sources on that, if you could stick them in the chat room, I don't know if you're online at all or not.
Actually,
that would be awesome.
Out of my
I would love to
I walked,
see.
I walked out of my office and got in my truck because I have people working in my office, and you wouldn't have had all this background chatter. While I was looking at the computer, as soon as you got to me, I ran out and got in my truck, so it'd be quiet.
Got it.
Because my office
got
there.
Appreciate
but yes,
that.
I can absolutely
so when,
put that
yeah,
in.
I'll leave the chat room open after the show after we close down the show, so you can post that link in there, because I would love to have a couple of links on that, and we'll make and post them on Lunch with Loudon's Facebook page too, so we can get that out. Because I would love to see those, see the sources on that, and go back and research that. And might be a topic for another show.
Well, yeah, because if you take, for example, the federal government has an informational website that posts all the government jobs that are coming up for contracting. It's FedBiz Op, I think, or whatever, and I'll post that too. And if you go on there, you can look at. I do military construction work. So, for example, I'll go into the Savannah District, which is I call the Savannah District, which is run by the Army Corps of Engineers for Florida, Georgia, Alabama area, and I'll bid on work that is coming out along with other contractors on this work, and it's all public information. Well, if you go and search within that construct, you will find that the Federal Prison Industries is competing with me. Let's say, not necessarily
right.
construction, but if I had a different kind of business, they're competing with me, and they
right.
and it lists all the contracts that they have won in the various areas of industry.
So getting back to our topic of the sequestration, austerity, and economy, and we got off topic a little bit on how government,
right.
you know, what is government supposed to do, and you're pointing out this unfair playing field and stuff that definitely is what government necessarily shouldn't be doing. So how is, you know, what are you thinking about? What are your thoughts on, this is your last wrap up because I've got 3 minutes to wrap
right.
up the show here. What are your thoughts on sequestration, austerity, the economic assumptions we're working under?
Well, again, the economic assumptions that we're working under are completely false, which is part of my point, both in the private side and on the government side. I think that one of the corners that we've been backed into is that the government is going to be forced to come out and create jobs for us because from the profit standpoint, all of the private industry jobs, or not all of them, but a good portion of them are overseas. We're not getting those jobs back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's the false assumption that is the problem. And anything that is arbitrarily done that way across the board,
yeah.
the impact of it is there's no way that it works, even for the reasoning that it is based in the first place, the debt and deficit and the budget. Nothing about the sequestration first of all, it's not real, and second, it doesn't work even if it was. You can't approach anything
right.
like that with a fine line. It will never work.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, the sequestration and just cutting across the board is something that I don't think we need to experience for ourselves, and it's a totally manufactured crisis, if you will. And I'm all for closing as quickly as possible that tax loophole that allows companies to actually take a tax write-off for shipping jobs overseas. I don't think they've closed it yet.
But you'd have to add to that. If you think about it, you'd have to add to that because you still leave the fact that the companies, let's say they left this country because we tax them too burden. That's one argument. So they go overseas
okay.
and they set up.
15 seconds, Robert, because we've got to go.
Okay, so they go overseas and set up, and then they still sell them products back to us country cheap. We've got to raise the standard in other countries where they pay people as well.
Got it. I appreciate your thoughts on that, Robert. So Lunch with Loudon here. Boy, it's been a lively show today, and I just appreciate all the participation. We got a great start. A big shout-out to Mattia Kramer from National Priorities Project. Just a reminder that we do have three other radio shows. We've got Politics Done Right with Egberto at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays. Monday night, we have Press One for Democracy with Dan Aronson that starts at 10 p.m. Eastern. And on Tuesdays, we have The Middle Ground with Michael Charney and Eric Beiler co-hosting that starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And as always, Coffee Party Radio is 100% membership supported. That is you. And we appreciate everything that you do for us to help support and keep Coffee Party Radio going, along with everything else that we do and try and get people involved and catalyze as citizens of our country instead of consumers of it. And you can get more information about that at coffeepartyusa.com. And thanks again for listening. Have a great afternoon.